Our next speaker is our very own Irina Mikhailovich, and she's a postdoctoral fellow at Washington University in St. Louis's Philosophy, Neuroscience, and Psychology program. And her work in the philosophy of science focuses on experimental methodology and inference making in investigations of the cognitive and psychological underpinnings of animal behavior. And she's already published in many of the best journals in our field. And today she's going to be talking about smart moves. Is behavioral flexibility evidence of cognitive complexity? Welcome.
Thanks, Russell. So many terrific questions have already been asked thus far, not least how we might view the nature and patterns of convergence, how we might understand cognition and its relationship to affect or motivation, if it has a relationship at all or if it's one and the same thing, and how we can understand the motivational drivers of behavior. And we heard a plea for useful abstraction, or so I like to interpret that talk. So in that spirit, I would like to offer my own abstraction and hope that it is a bit useful. So animal cognition is typically defined as the processes that generate flexible adaptive behavior in animals. So this is a quote from Kirsten Andrews. It's an entry on animal cognition in the Philosopher's Online Bible, Standard Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So it's a reliable source. Now, this conception of cognition is motivated by a plausible assumption, namely that flexible behavior is underwritten by cognitive processes. Okay? And that the more flexible the observed behavior, the more complex the cognitive processes that drive it. Now, this assumption shapes research programs in comparative cognition, where behavioral flexibility is treated as the gold standard of evidence for cognitive complexity. And this assumption has particular methodological and inferential consequences. So experiments are deliberately designed to elicit flexible behaviors, and observations of flexible behaviors are in turn thought to license inferences about the presence of more complex forms of cognition. The problem, however, is that despite the veritable consensus that flexible behaviors are evidence of complex cognitive mechanisms, this evidential link has not yet been explicitly defended. Now you might think, why do we need to explicitly defend it? Isn't it obvious? Well, I think it needs to be explicitly defended, and this need is particularly pressing because flexible behaviors can often be explained by a variety of cognitive mechanisms. So the fact that flexible behaviors can often be explained by a variety of cognitive mechanisms results in a problem of underdetermination, where evidence of behavioral flexibility does not permit us necessarily to adjudicate theories regarding the underlying cognition. One common but I think problematic solution to this underdetermination problem in comparative cognition is to always err on the side of the simpler hypothesis. In effect, to reject more complex explanations unless all simpler ones have been ruled out. So perhaps some of you are familiar with this move. The trouble with this approach, however, is that a strong bias for explanations that cite simpler cognitive mechanisms not only attenuates the link between behavioral flexibility and cognitive complexity that seems to motivate a lot of the research, but also stands in need of justification. And all justifications thus far for the simplicity preference have, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, but stand behind it, been inadequate. An alternative solution is to reject the preference for simplicity, and to show that the underdetermination problem is in fact a pseudo-problem, one which disappears once empirical and theoretical considerations external to the experimental setting have been taken into account. So in today's talk, I opt for the latter approach. And I argue that once cognitive complexity and behavioral flexibility are conceptually disentangled, once the strong preference for simplicity is abandoned, and once the full spectrum of evidence is accorded its proper weight, the underdetermination problem disappears. And an evolutionary argument in support of the prevailing assumption that behavioral flexibility serves as evidence of cognitive complexity begins to take shape. I'll propose a model that provides theoretical support for the prevailing assumption, which I, and I should say my co-authors, who I often have credited at the beginning of this, but I'll credit at the end, call the adaptive triadic model of cognitive behavioral evolution. This model suggests that or rather it argues that the evidence of convergent brain behavior environment clusters in disparate lineages can serve as evidence for the same trait environment clusters in other lineages. And this can, I'll argue, under certain circumstances, shift the burden of proof onto the simpler cognitive explanations of observed behavior, thus hopefully vindicating the prevailing intuition that behavioral flexibility can serve as reliable evidence of cognitive complexity. And more broadly, I hope that we will use this conference, and I've seen this happen already, as a way of exploring the ways in which evolutionary theory can further inform research in comparative cognition. And I am so pleased not to be even remotely alone in that. So, the first step. As we saw, the received view in comparative cognition holds that animal cognition is constituted by the processes, that used to generate flexible behavior in animal species. But by building behavioral outputs into the definition of cognition, the link between behavioral flexibility and particular cognitive mechanisms is established by definitional fiat. This creates a problem, however. Namely, one phenomenon cannot serve as evidence for another phenomenon when the two are defined in terms of one another. So building complex cognitive mechanisms into our definition of behavioral flexibility may not be problematic where proximate causes of certain behaviors have already been established, but it is a problem when behavioral flexibility is called upon to serve as evidence for cognitive complexity. So I'll call this the special circularity problem in comparative cognition. And it's a special circularity problem that can be found outside of comparative cognition as well. In this case, it's specifically about behavioral flexibility and cognitive complexity. So to make this a little clearer, consider a parallel or analogous case. In the post-Darwinian days of biology, natural design was the key explanandum, the key thing to be explained. And natural selection was increasingly accepted as the best explanation. Now, over the years, as it became clear that natural selection was the only game in town for explaining biological design, biological function came to be defined as traits produced by the mechanism of natural selection. Now, the situation in comparative cognition is very different. Here, the mechanistic explanation of observed behavior is precisely what's at issue. And so, if behavioral flexibility is to serve as evidence of cognitive complexity, we need to keep these concepts analytically separate. Now, granted, there's a very weak sense in which behavioral flexibility can serve as evidence of cognitive complexity, even when cognitive complexity is part of the definition of behavioral flexibility. So, for example, if I know that a pine is a kind of tree, and there before me is a pine, I can now say that I have evidence, in a loose sense, that I also see a tree. But hopefully everyone can see that this sense of evidence is uninteresting. And this is because it tells us nothing new about the world. In other words, it is non-ampliative. Similarly, if cognitive complexity is built into the definition of behavioral flexibility, then behavioral flexibility can only serve as evidence for cognitive complexity in this non-ampliative sense. But amplifying our knowledge of underlying causal structures is precisely what experiments aim to do. It is as crucial for the evidentiary project that our definitions of behavioral flexibility and cognitive complexity remain analytically separable. Now, as we've seen, current definitions of behavioral flexibility and cognition are not analytically separable, and so we need a definition of each that doesn't build one into the other. So I'll start with this. And this will, in turn, hopefully set the stage for a defense of the prevailing view that behavioral flexibility can serve as evidence of cognitive complexity. So consider behavioral flexibility first. My co-authors and I view behavioral flexibility as a distinct type of behavioral plasticity, which in turn should be understood as a distinct type of phenotypic plasticity. Now, phenotypic plasticity refers to the modifiability of traits, both morphological and behavioral, in response to environmental inputs. An organism is behaviorally plastic when its behaviors are governed by conditions of expression that are modifiable via environmental input. So in some cases, this modifiability is limited to early ontogeny, and the behaviors become rigid or fixed thereafter. For instance, as when eusocial insect caste membership is determined during the rearing of the pupae. In other cases, animals can modify their behaviors later in life, but they do so rigidly. So that is in accordance with pre-environmentally determined rules. For instance, this is the case with when adult haremic marine wrasses switch sexes upon the death of a dominant male. And I'm sure you can all think of many other cases. So in contrast, finally getting to the flexibility part. In contrast, behaviorally flexible organisms are capable of modifying their behaviors and the rules governing the expression of their behavior significantly throughout their lifetime. And they do so based on experience. So this might be familiar to some. This is, for instance, the case with constellation behavior among ravens. I shamelessly pulled this from the internet, from Thomas's slides. I hope, am I allowed to use it? Excellent, thank you. I have no money, so. Anyway, this is also true with the case of problem solving, and as I've illustrated with the case, the octopus there preparing to open a jar, which we heard earlier could happen, they could do.
Give me a chance to talk about
30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yep.
Excellent, okay. So behavioral flexibility allows organisms to respond flexibly to the vagaries of their selective environment. Now notice that we've defined behavioral flexibility without any mention of cognitive mechanisms that produce it. Similarly, we can define cognitive complexity without building in behavioral outputs. So because both cognition and complexity are notoriously slippery concepts, our best bet is to adopt the least controversial account of cognition. Here's one. It'll make everybody somewhat satisfied and nobody happy. So in this case, we want to define cognition as a form of information processing. This is probably the most popular account of cognition in cognitive science right now, and it is the dominant view in comparative cognition as well. So Sarah Shuttleworth's canonical definition, for instance, holds that cognition refers to the mechanisms by which animals acquire, process, store, and act on information from the environment. And she goes on to talk about what some of these things are. Now, Shuttleworth's approach is a big tent approach. It grants minimal forms of cognition to a wide variety of organisms with very different neurological capacities, sensory modalities, and life ways. And a clear advantage of such a phylogenetically inclusive account is that it fits well into an evolutionary ecological framework. It permits cross-species comparisons and generates evolutionary hypotheses. It's broad enough to capture many or all types of cognition, and it, more than any other account, has the potential to explain why cognition exists in the forms and taxonomic distribution that it does. Moreover, an information processing account has the potential to explain how cognition might scale in complexity and how the scaling might map onto more sophisticated forms of behavioral flexibility. So how might the scaling look? Well, it's tempting to think that cognition increases in complexity in proportion to the total amount of information that an organism can extract and process. On this view, if we could quantify the total information processing by a system, then we would come up with a clear metric for cognitive complexity. Unfortunately, this view is a non-starter. Greater amounts of information processing may, in fact, hinder flexible behavioral performance in a number of ways, for instance, by slowing an organism down. So we suggest that cognitive complexity of an organism is not a function of the sheer amount of information that it can process, but rather of the types of information that it can process. Environmental information may be broken down roughly into two types. Now, information about concrete features of the environment and information about abstract features of the environment. So the former includes features that are available to perception, while the latter includes such things as concepts, causal and constitutive relations, abstract properties such as presence or sameness. And cognitive systems that extract and act on abstract information generally map onto cognitive systems that researchers take to be more complex than those that extract and act only on concrete information. So on this view, a bacterium that can detect and respond to simple chemical gradients will be less cognitively and behaviorally complex, but nevertheless be cognitive, than a bee that can form bound representations of specific flowers and landmarks, store them in memory, and use those to form associations and rely on them to guide future action. Okay, having decoupled behavioral flexibility and cognitive complexity, we now have an account for which the link between complex cognitive capacities and flexible behaviors is a contingent, not an analytic one. This, in turn, allows cognitive complexity to feature in mechanistic explanations of behavioral flexibility, and for behavioral flexibility to serve as evidence for cognitive complexity. However, there is a rub. On this account, observed flexible behavior may be underwritten by simpler cognitive mechanisms. And recognizing this possibility opens up the widespread problem of evidential underdetermination in comparative cognition. The problem that behavioral evidence is in experiment often appears to be consistent with multiple cognitive explanations. Now, one way, as I briefly mentioned, that researchers have tried to get around this underdetermination problem is by following a heuristic of always preferring the simplest cognitive or non-cognitive explanation for a given observed behavior, so setting that maybe as the null hypothesis or as the default. While a lot more may be said about this approach, for reasons of time, I'll simply say that I think that an a priori preference for simpler explanations is supported neither by general logical considerations, nor by logical theory, nor by the methodological goals of animal cognition science. I'll therefore consider an alternative to the problem of underdetermination. Whoops, there you go. Shouldn't do that. One that involves taking into account a biological evidence base that extends well beyond the confines of experiment or even field observation in order to adjudicate competing hypotheses about the mechanisms underlying animal behavior. And if successful, and hopefully you can all help me out here, the solution would both address the apparent underdetermination problem and support the prevailing notion that behavioral flexibility can serve as evidence of cognitive complexity. So how are flexible behaviors and complex cognition causally linked? Well, let's leave the laboratory and field setting for a moment and take a broader ecological and historical view. I should say also leave the philosopher's armchair. So when we imagine animals evolving into the forms we see today, it seems plausible that the evolution of behavioral flexibility would be connected to the emergence of more sophisticated cognitive mechanisms, and that these in turn would be connected to the evolution of sophisticated brains. We've seen some mention of this already today. But this intuition arguably drives Peter Godfrey Smith's environmental complexity thesis, according to which the evolutionary function of cognition is to enable organisms to interact in fitness-enhancing ways with a heterogeneous environment. Cognitive processes that do this on his view, they do this on his view by exploiting ecologically relevant information. Now, here, information is taken in the Dretskian sense to describe law-like probabilistic correlations between states of variables. For instance, if chemicals in the ambient environment predict the presence of relevant predators, food, competitors, mates, then we might expect that organisms will tend to evolve the capacity to detect these chemicals and to produce ecologically appropriate behaviors in response. Yet the concept of heterogeneity is notoriously difficult to define and operationalize, and this makes it hard to compare environmental heterogeneity across very different animal groups, and Godfrey Smith was not particularly optimistic about the possibility of doing this. So instead of proposing a single definition, he takes a more modest route. He contends that the heterogeneity cognition hypothesis serves as a model that can be applied on a case-by-case basis. And if it provides a successful account of the evolution of cognition, in many cases, then it may be generalized to a still broader range of cases. And we propose something really similar and similarly modest in offering a unified account of the broader evidential context for adjudicating among competing experimental hypotheses. So according to what we call the adaptive triadic model of cognitive behavioral evolution, three elements serve as non-circular, though I have something of a circle there, non-circular and mutually reinforcing sources of evidence for the presence of cognitive complexity. And these are behavioral flexibility, environmental heterogeneity, and the neuroanatomical structures associated with increasingly complex information processing. And as we've seen, pinning down what those correlates exactly are is quite a task, and it remains an open task. But what gives this model traction is the idea that the convergent evolution of similar trait-environment pairings in phylogenetically disparate groups of organisms may constitute what we might call natural experiments, which support the existence of certain non-accidental adaptive trait-environment clusters. So let me unpack this. We know that convergent evolution can serve as evidence for adaptive hypotheses, right? So for instance, ichthyosaurs, mesozoic marine mammals, and dolphins independently evolved dorsal fins and pectoral flippers or pectoral fins in an aquatic environment. And this strongly suggests that these structures have similar evolutionary functions. Now, philosopher Adrian Curry sketches a schematic for such inferences. On his view, a known pattern of convergence allows us to project a certain trait combination observed in known or model lineages onto a target lineage that are known to exhibit some but not all of the traits in the model cluster. And this projectability hinges on a particular relation between model and target lineages. So in the case of homology relations, this projection is justified by the reliable inheritance of developmentally interconnected features. In the case of convergence, this projection is justified by a biological regularity, whose causes are largely external to the lineages in question, namely a shared selection regime. Now, convergent regularities can allow us to infer certain traits on the basis of certain selective environments, certain selective environments on the basis of certain traits, and certain traits from the existence of other traits given a particular selective environment. So, for instance, since we know that the dorsal fins and pectoral flippers form trait clusters in connection with fully aquatic vertebrate lifestyles, such that we can expect, say, to find dorsal fins in a new species of marine animal that we know to have pectoral fins and vice versa. Similarly, the adaptive triadic model argues that robust convergent regularity that includes behavioral flexibility, cognitive complexity, and neurological signatures of cognitive complexity described at an appropriate grain of resolution and a heterogeneous selective environment. Now, insofar as the regularity holds across distant lineages with disparate body plans and developmental constraints, it is unlikely to be the product of chance or due to quirky facts about particular lineages. The more such instances of this cluster we find in very disparate animal groups, the greater the likelihood that the trait cluster together non-accidentally due to constraints that are external to the converging lineages. And thus, the more evolutionarily robust the regularity will be. On this model, we can be reasonably sure that should we find one or two of these traits elsewhere in a species that evolved in a heterogeneous environment, we will also find the second or third trait, including traits that are not directly observable, like cognitive complexity. And if this, And if this relationship is borne out empirically, as preliminary data suggests, and we're currently compiling the evidence, including from work of everybody here, then behavioral flexibility could serve as reasonably strong evidence of cognitive complexity for those lineages that evolved in heterogeneous selective environments and that boast enlarged or denser, more interconnected neural structures. In contrast, where critical traits of the cluster are lacking, for example, if the organisms lack relevant neuroanatomical correlates or their lysa, they live in a homogeneous environment, then inferences to cognitive complexity will be on shakier ground. So let's flesh out the ATM a little bit more, beginning with environmental heterogeneity. So we've already seen wonderful examples of this, and heterogeneity may refer to any aspect of an organism's ecology, such as foraging, sociality, predation, etc. But what makes each one of these aspects heterogeneous? Well, it's a tricky question, but here's a working definition. Environment A of evolving lineage X is more heterogeneous than environment B of evolving lineage Y only if A contains more fitness-relevant informational signals in relation to X than B does in relation to Y. And by fitness-relevant informational signals, you might be wondering what we mean. That refers to informational signals about states of affairs in the world that would, if detected and acted upon, have some net statistical effect on organismic fitness. These signals can be measured along two dimensions: their variability, or the number of types of signals, and predictability, or the regularity of the signal pattern. For example, an animal's social environment is more variable the more types of calls, postures, and conspecific interactions she needs to keep track of. And it is predictable relative to the stable meaning of these cues. relatively uniform and predictable environments will tend to result in the evolution of a narrow range of rigid behavioral repertoires that avoid the cost of learning. Predictable and variable environments will tend to result in a wider range of rigid behavioral repertoires. And unpredictable environments will tend to result in the evolution of behavioral flexibility, barring evolvability constraints. So given this conception of heterogeneity, our model predicts the following: that complex cognition and flexible behavior capacities will fail to evolve, or if they already exist to evolve, will begin to degrade due to the relaxation of stabilizing selection in environments where one of the following conditions holds. There are either few fitness-relevant informational signals, there are many fitness-relevant signals, but detecting them or responding to them entails a net loss of fitness due to some evolutionary trade-off, or there are many fitness-relevant signals, but evolvability constraints prevent phenotypic variation as a result of which signal detection systems never arise. Conversely, we might expect behavioral flexibility to arise when animal lifeways strongly incentivize the detection and processing of a range of informational signals whose natures and sources vary substantially over time. For instance, if a generalist predator is confronted with many different prey types that vary over space and time, they will, barring constraints, tend to develop flexible strategies of predation. That's in the case of the jumping spider, for instance. So if this theoretical sketch is correct in the broad strokes, then we should find evidence of the trait environment cluster across phylogenetically distant lineages. And indeed, there's a growing body of evidence linking complexification or increases in neuronal density with flexible problem-solving and abilities in heterogeneous environments in a wide variety of animal lineages, from mammals, birds, mollusks, and arthropods. And the empirical data that we've begun to compile in support of this conversion regularity is rich. But in the interest of time, I'll close by considering a potential objection to the model, which in fact proves, it relies on a counterexample that, as it turns out, proves the rule. So the objection runs as follows. The social brain hypothesis, which is a subset of our model, predicts that animals living in heterogeneous social environments will tend to evolve larger brains and more complex brains to enable them to navigate their complex social landscape. But highly social ants are relatively less encephalized than their free-living wasp ancestors. So at first blush, this seems to rebuff the social brain hypothesis and the social intelligence hypothesis, and by implication, our model, particularly because it seeks to establish a regularity that applies across phyla, a regularity that's not limited to vertebrates. However, this tension disappears upon closer inspection. And this is because the evolution of highly specialized eusocial insect colonies is not a case of increased social complexity or heterogeneity. Rather, it constitutes the emergence of a new evolutionary individual. And the evolution of individuality involves an increased specialization of parts, which in turn results in a reduction of functional complexity of the parts, of the subparts. This is true of the evolution of complex multicellularity. Here, individual cells of a multicellular organism, freed up from having to perform all the functions of their single-celled eukaryotic ancestors, can afford to become specialists. The same principle seems to also hold for ants, and specifically for ant cognition, when they transition to obligate eusocial colonies from their free-living generalist hymenopteran ancestors. Crucially, the basis for this cognitive functional reduction is the reduced information processing needs of individual members of specialized insect castes. So this leads to the winnowing of cognitive capacities and a corresponding reduction in brain size. And our model predicts that an increased division of labor will correlate with reduced behavioral flexibility and reduced neuroanatomical complexity at the individual level. And in fact, this prediction holds broadly for eusocial insects, where group size is inversely proportional to behavioral flexibility, as well as to brain size. Thus, in such cases, they may present as strong counterexamples to our model until we look more closely. Once heterogeneity is properly spelled out, we can see that such counterexamples actually support the model. I had another example of the giant panda, but I'll just let you look at the adorable picture and move on. This is another outlier to our model that looks like a sequel. All right, thank you very much.